Session number 16726, Mr. Harry, or H. Bell, reel 15.
Mr. Bell, reel 15. You were setting off home, Mr. Bell.
Yes, we went. We went to the airstrip at Calcutta, and we waited for a while. And while I was there, a peculiar thing happened. It was a Tarmac Adams strip, and we were on it. And there was an Indian who was naked except for a loincloth. It came up with two women who were carrying baskets on their head. And he got us to gather around, and the women dumped this basket that was full of soil. And they dumped this basket of soil on the tarmac adam, and then stood back, and he came forward, and he had a mango stone, a mango fruit stone in his hand, and he placed the mango stone on the top of the heap of soil, threw a dirty piece of cloth over it, stood back and said the magic words and waved the magic stick, and this little hump on top of the heap of soil grew and grew and grew till it was about 3 foot high. And he whipped it off, and lo and behold, there was a mango bush growing out of the top of the soil. Now, I know, being suspicious of that, I knew that you can be sort of half hypnotized. So I got forward and I pulled a leaf off the bush. And it was genuine. How on earth that was ever done, I'll never know. It always stood out in my mind, because afterwards I had this leaf and it was a real leaf. There was no hypnotism about it at all. I came across two or three things like that. These Indian magicians will leave British stage magicians standing. I saw one in Bombay, in one of the streets in Bombay. He had a boy with him, a young slim boy of about 5 foot, and he had a large concave sided basket, rather large, like the size of a clothes basket, and he got the boy to lie down inside the basket and curl around inside the concave sides, and he pulled the cloth over the top, and then he jumped in and kicked all the way around, and the lad had disappeared. He jumped up, pulled the cloth out, and upset the lad. I came across two or three instances of these men, and they were very, very clever, very good. You just can't explain it at all. It happened, and that was it. And I know it wasn't imagination. I saw it happen.
At the airport, what craft did you fly out on?
An old English bomber. I can't remember. Was it Halifax, was it? Halifax, I think.
What are your memories of the journey?
Very uncomfortable, but a marvellous prospect. the officer in charge was very much the Barra Sahib. The plane was divided into two parts. There was the Bombay, which had seats in, and upstairs, where we were. And it was, for this officer, it was a question of sergeants with him above and other ranks down in the Bombay. So we had the best of it, such as it was, because there was no comfort. There was no comfort. The toilet was at the tail end of the plane, and if you wanted to go, you had to notify the pilot to rectify the balance, because it would tip. We were given boiled sweets to suck. Remember that? Boiled sweets to suck for air sickness, I think. No, I'm wrong about the Halifax. We flew from Calcutta to across India to. We flew across India in a Dakota. Marvelous craft, the Dakota, a good workhorse. Still flying now, I think. Dakotas are. So we flew across there in a Dakota, which was very uncomfortable, little canvas bucket seats on the side, and we got right across to the west coast of India, to an airport there, and then we transferred to the, I think it was a Halifax. A very disturbing thing happened there. We took off from there to go home, and we had been up 20 minutes when they suddenly discovered that one of the wing, the petrol tanks in the wing, the cap had been left off. So we had to go back again with full tanks, which is not a very good situation at all, from what I understand from the Air Force. Anyway, we got back and put a cover on, and we flew off. A marvellous liaison between the air crew, who were going home, time served, and us. So all the time we were there, it was little notes being passed backwards and forwards, and they kept in touch with us all the time, telling us what to look for and everything else. And it was quite good that way, that we decided how far we were going to fly that day and where we would stop. And I remember when we got to the Mediterranean, you know, I saw a marvellous sight when I was flying up the Red Sea. Below us, we were flying about 10,000 feet. And below us, somewhere about 6,000 feet or so, there was an echelon of geese, white geese. There must have been about 50 or 60 of them flying in an arrowhead formation. And the pure white on a dark brown background. It was a sight I'll never forget, beautiful sight. Anyway, we got to Africa, and we stopped there. And then when we took off from there, and we got a little note back, we stopped at Castel Bonito, which was a reinforcement camp in North Africa. So we stopped there. I'm wrong. We stopped for the best part of a week to get acclimatized beside Jerusalem. I don't remember much about it. We were just impatient to get home, but we did. We stopped there for about a week for acclimatization. And then we took off and we went to Castel Bonito, which was a huge deserted reinforcement camp. Masses and masses of bell tents, nobody there, just us. and then the next morning, the usual consultation took place, and the air crew said, "Now, do we stop in France on the way back, or do we fly straight to England? We fly straight to England, don't we? So we didn't land in France at all. We flew on and on and on, and we landed on the southeast coast of England. I don't know exactly where. It was nighttime when we landed, and it was a beautiful thought, touching down in England again. Even though it was that time of night, there was hot tea and sandwiches waiting for us and everything else. Back on the old UK again.
What date was it?
Round about September, I don't know. It's a long time ago and dates are very vague.
1945.
But it was night time when we arrived, and as I say, we got the sandwiches and everything else, and we got a bed for the night. The next day, we went into London. And I had my first pint of beer, a British beer, for all those years, and I hated it. It was London beer, of course, which is bad at any time. And I left half of it. I couldn't drink it. Probably because I was that used to drinking short drinks. But anyway, I left it. And from there, we went to it's off, isn't it? No. We went to a camp, a Beeston Castle, just outside of Chester. And it was an amazing camp. There were over 2,000 sergeants and above there, falling over each other, with second lieutenants trying to take charge. It was Fred Carnot's army. There was all sorts of rules and regulations that fires mustn't be lit before a certain time. We were all fresh from a hot climate, and you weren't supposed to light a fire before 5 o'clock at night. And there were RSMs and CSMs and also and us lowly sergeants, of course. And the parades, the morning parades, were controlled by corporals. Well, it was a most funny sight to see that they all get a parade, and then all of a sudden, three sergeant majors would start walking off. Where are you going, sir? It's bloody cold. We're going for to get a coat on, you know, and off they used to wander. And I remember when at 4 o'clock, we were out there, and we had a fire on in the billet, a big roaring fire on in the billet. And this second lieutenant came in, poked his head on the corner. You're not supposed to have fires on, you fellows. Get lost. There was a big rush. There was RSMs and so on in the cookhouse. Everybody wanted a job in the cookhouse because it was nice and warm. The whole thing was, because I had a job which I didn't like at all. I was in charge of the bus, which used to run to take people into Chester in the evening and bring them back again at night. The one fear that we had, all of us, was the fact that we got in a charge of some sort. There was one sergeant was held back from going home because he was in charge of the jail, and some of the prisoners had. These were all young recruits, you know, and they had heated the stove lid up red hot and burnt their way out of the roof of the jail. And he was held back, for goodness knows how long, till the court case was heard, court martial. So what we were, anyway, I had this job of taking this bus into Chester at night, staying there, and then coming back with it at about 10 o'clock, quarter past 10. And it was terrible. It wasn't so bad going, but coming back, I had more passengers than what I had room for. Also trying to get on, and I was having to force them off and keep them off. And I was dead scared of getting into trouble, you know. It wasn't very pleasant. It was nice enough going into Chester every night, except for money reasons, but it was awful fending them off and stopping them from getting on the bus if they didn't have a ticket. I wasn't very popular.
Had you had any kind of welcome at all, you know, coming back from Burma after such a length of time? Was any interest shown in?
None. No. We just went there and that's it. No.
So how long were you in this camp before you got leave?
We were sent home at Christmas. They didn't know what to do with us. 2,000 sons and above. They didn't know what to do with us. So they told us to stay a fortnight's leave at Christmas, and told us to stay for another 2 weeks. Not to come back until the end of January, I think it was near the end of January, which I did do. It was very nice getting home, a nice long leave, excepting by the fact that a New Year I got malaria, didn't I? I got a really upset malaria, and I spent this New Year's Eve, I remember in the bed, and with a cloud of steam rising off the bed, and all my relatives sitting round, Happy New Year, and I had a cloud of steam flying off me. I was a real attack of malaria.
How were you received when you did go home? What was the welcome you got there?
Well, I'm a bit vague about it. I've thought about this even before you asked about it. The journey home was a long. I had a carriage to myself. It was a miserable sort of day. And went up the coast to Carlisle, and the train steamed. We stuck forever in Carlisle. That's a hell of a station, Carlisle. It's a dreary, dismal station at any time. And I was there. And when I arrived, my wife was there, and all the family, including my father, who had got over but had a false leg, had a false ankle on then. And they were all there. And looking back, I feel rather ashamed because I seem to have walked past everybody and grabbed my wife. I suppose it's a natural thing to do. I don't remember saying much to anybody else. I just remember going home and all the rest trailing behind. Maybe a natural thing to do, but it's on my conscience that I did this, and I didn't say hello to everybody else.
Did you have the bunting out in the street? The flags and the bunting, were they out for?
Oh, you? No, Dad, the war was over, wasn't it? We were the forgotten army. The war had been over. Nobody said a word. Nobody said a word. Me going home with my son's stripes and my bronze face and my bush hat. No. Went out drinking, and father and sister kept my uniform on. And this is my son. As my father being an old soldier, he was proud of it. And I don't think I told you about this, but when he was having his leg off, I was at a reinforcement depot then, and I wanted to come home to see him, and you know, on compassionate leave, and he refused to ask me. He refused because if I had gone home, I would have lost my stripes. I would have lost my war substantive stripes, and he wouldn't let me come home. He wouldn't ask me to come home. So anyway, when I did get home, there he was, hale and hearty, good old soldier, my father, good sergeant major. And there he was, and the first opportunity out, we went for a pint. This is my son, you know. What was it? Have a pint. No, the war was over, Harry. The war was over. It was forgotten. We were forgotten. I wasn't expecting much, but I didn't get anything at all. Nothing at all. I just got home, and I was glad to be home.
With your leave over, what happened to you then?
I went back to the camp after leave, and then I got my demob leave, which was 3 months. I was only back for a week or two, and then I got demob leave. Went up to York, got outfitted in the usual demob suit, which was a navy blue pinstripe and a trilby hat and a tie. The only thing that fitted me was the tie, I think. But anyway, that's what I got. And that was the end of my army career.
Had you a medical before you went out, before they sent you out?
I don't recall getting one. I don't recall getting one.
What was the process of demob? You got to York, and how did the process you?
Well, you went and handed your papers in and so on, and you went through this huge room with racks of trousers, racks of shirts, racks of anything, this, what size, and this, that, here, which one do you want? That one, you know. You're fully kitted out. I have a photograph, and I look rather like a Chicago gangster.
Did you keep your uniform?
Yes. I not only kept my uniform, I also kept my blue derry. Now, blue derry is a blue rug which you sleep on, and my blankets, and they were beautiful Australian blankets, pure wool. Everybody wanted them. They were beautiful pure wool blankets, navy blue and grey with a red bone end edging. Beautiful blankets. My overcoat, I had to pay for that, I think. I think I had to pay for my overcoat. It's one of these things in the army that they're special. If you either hand it in or you take it and pay half a crown, something. It was a ridiculous price, but you had to pay for it.
How did you settle down after army routine, living in the jungle? How did you settle down in England straight away?
Terrible. I walked the house. I paced the house. I went out at 10, half past 10, 11 o'clock at night for a walk. I couldn't settle. It was bad. I was on edge. I missed all the main. I missed the surroundings. And I was a bundle of nerves. took me quite a while to settle down, but I've seen me walking one. I was pulled up by a policeman at 2 o'clock in the morning. Wouldn't know what I was doing out. Told him.
Did you find it difficult to sleep? Obviously, you must have done if you were walking all the time.
Oh, difficult to sleep. Oh, I'm glad you asked me that. I'm going to track back a little bit now. When I was leaving, I did get a medical before I came on the plane. I did get a medical because at that time I had two huge ringworms, one in each cheek of my backside. When I tried to get them off, I used a strong disinfectant I put on, and they peeled off like apple rings, but it appeared again straight afterwards. And when I went for a medical, I stood up and tried to drop him, and I dropped him, and I turned round. "Good God," he says. I thought he said he were in the army. What he got the Air Force motives for? he asked me then, "Are there any children with ringworm?" If they wouldn't let me go if there were any children at all. But there were no children at all, so I had that. I also had Bengal foot rot, which is rather like athlete's foot. The skin peels up and your feet are stinking. So when you asked me if I slept, I slept with my feet out the bottom of the bed. The smell was so bad. I wouldn't sleep in the same bed with you. And I said, "Put my feet out the bottom of the bed." Terrible. Bengal foot rot.
So there were difficult days both for yourself and your wife at that time.
Yes, yes. Rather difficult. After what had been in your mind all those years, the actuality of it, it wasn't what you expected. No. When you were lying there dreaming about going home and getting away, you forget about all the practical side of it, and I say the Bengal foot rot was one of it.
Did you suffer from nightmares or recurring dreams?
No, I've never had nightmares. No, I've never had nightmares at all.
How long did this take then for you to settle down?
Well, I had a 3 months leave. I think my pay was about £5 a week, which was quite good in those days, and my wife was working too, so we were all out for money. I don't know. I would say it's very hard to say. About a month, I would think, though, before I got into a routine. A worrying time. I went back to see, but I don't think I said this, I went back to see about my job, which was a furniture salesman, and it reminded me I'd been suspended when I went into the army, and lo and behold, I was still suspended after 6 years. Still suspended. My job wasn't there. There wasn't any furniture to sell.
This was suspension because you volunteered rather than waiting.
I didn't volunteer.
Oh, you didn't. Why were you suspended?
Because there was nobody buying any furniture. There was no sales. So I was suspended, and I was suspended when I came back. And I went and complained to the Labour Exchange because we had been promised our jobs back. And they couldn't do a thing about it. I was still suspended. So we had a job there. I went on a trading estate, all the factories and everywhere else. But I was giving up hope when one day my wife worked in a grocery shop, and she said, one of her customers came in and said that they were setting messengers on for the civil service, which had just opened up in this area, and said, "Put your uniform on and go across." And she said, "I put my uniform on and went in, and I had no problem. I was accepted as a messenger," which was a lowly sort of job, uniform, with crown badges and the lapels. You know, give me a bit of stomach. at least you had something to look at. The medal, crowns on. But they're very, very badly paid. It was a job which had been meant for pension, ex-army pension, ex-forces pensioners. The money was very poor. Fortunately, my wife was still working, and so we managed. And within 6 months, I got promotion to what they call a block messenger. I was in charge of all the messengers in one block. My NCO's authority coming into it there. Anyway, I got that, and I had about 12 messengers working for me. And then I sat another exam and got to be paper keeper, which was in charge of all the files in one particular area, which was another increase in pay. I wasn't doing so badly then. And I had previously thought about transferring to the other side, the office side, and I went to see it, but they said, stay where you are, you'll do better, and you'll get more chance of promotion if you stay on the uniform side, which I did. And it did happen. And so I sat there, and then I sat an open exam for clerical officer. And I got a clerical officer in charge of some grade two workers, office workers. And then after I had been clerical officer for about 4 years, I heard that they wanted civil servants to work for the social securities outside, national assistance as it was then. Men over 40, they wanted with experience. So I transferred and I went under that side, that is, visiting cases where they were applying for national assistance. And I carried on there, started off at Jarrow and Tyne office, and then I was transferred to Felling office, and then Gated office and Felling office combined into the Gated office, and I went there. I did an awful lot of acting up, doing executive work, filling in and time when anybody was off. I did more time as an executive officer than I did as a clerical officer, and eventually I got aboard and I passed and became an executive officer.
What's the thing you miss most about your army experiences?
As a comradeship. Nobody had anything to lose or to gain. We're all in the same boat. As a lance corporal, and I didn't get promotion because in the signal platoon there are only a signal sergeant, signal corporal, and four at the most lance corporals. As nobody died or got killed or anything, you just can't, and you can't go to duty, so you just stay where you are as a lance corporal. There's no chance of promotion, even though I was a first-class instructor. So you had that little bit of authority, a cut above the rank and file. You had a corporal's mess to go to, which had no fees. It wasn't bad. I wouldn't say I enjoyed it, but It was bearable. And the friends, as a messenger, they were all ex-servicemen. Although it was a badly paid, poor job, whenever you wanted a job done, everybody buckled to and got it done. You worked as per the army. And so it was quite nice. The comradeship was good. It made it bearable.